Hello and welcome to The Urbanist, Monocle's programme all about the built environment. I'm your host, Andrew Tuck. Coming up...
It's part of why I believe in the need for citizens' assemblies that create the spaces for diverse groups of people to spend lengthy periods of time doing hard work together. And there's no magic shortcut to kind of rebuilding that trust and giving people a real sense of agency.
Who has the power in our cities? This week we look at democracy in urban areas and how to make decision-making more inclusive and open to all. We'll hear about a new report on democratising city planning, hear how the voters' choice in the upcoming election in Belgrade will have a direct impact on the future of public transit, and take a step back to hear how candidates end up on the ballot paper in the very first place. All that and much, much more over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Anyone who's been to a town hall meeting will likely be aware of the constraints of this particular form of participatory urbanism. Often people of a particular demographic, often with the same negative or self-interested views, tend to hijack these sorts of forums. So how do we make sure that a wide demographic of the public with constructive ideas are able to have their voices heard and, crucially, are listened to? Democracy Next, the international non-profit, non-partisan research institute, has recently released their 6 ways to democratise city planning. It outlines some ideas for creating a deeper culture of engagement in our city planning processes. Earlier, Monocle's Carlo Trabello was joined by Claudia Schwalis, the founder and CEO of Democracy Next. Carlotta began by asking Claudia why Democracy Next decided to publish this paper.
Yeah, it's a good place to start about why do this work? Why are we even exploring these questions? Well, the idea of how do we transform our cities is one of the kind of bigger picture questions. And how do we transform the governance of how are we taking decisions? Who is taking them in a bigger picture way? And in the work that we've been doing at Democracy Next, one of my colleagues is an architect as well. We've been interviewing all sorts of different kinds of actors in cities across the world. So speaking with public servants, architects, urbanists, obviously citizens, people who are working with different civil society organizations and so on, and seeing that actually everybody, every actor in the system, also developers and investors too, have different problems with how the current decision-making systems around planning works. Kind of nobody is happy. There's a strategic opportunity to be rethinking not just how we could be kind of maybe having better public engagement on planning, but how could we be changing the system in a more structural way so that every time there are new decisions to be taken around new housing developments, new planning decisions that will impact communities locally, that we're taking those in a different way and shifting who has power to involve citizens in a much more meaningful way, but also rethinking what is their relationship to all those other actors in the system in a holistic way.
Now, one thing that's interesting here is that while it might sound similar, it's not necessarily participatory urbanism. It is about finding, as you were describing, the ways that everyone, all these different actors, can be involved in the decisions that are happening. So perhaps just to explain it, that difference, how is this different than participatory urbanism or initiatives that come from the community sphere?
Yeah, it's a good point of clarification, actually. So at the heart of all of these proposals are what are called citizens' assemblies. And these are assemblies that bring together a randomly selected but broadly representative group of people living in a community, but for an extended period of time. So usually that will mean somewhere between 4 to 6 to 10, you know, a longer period of time, many days over a course of a few months, to be able to learn more in depth about a policy issue. So in this case, something to do with planning, housing, mobility, etc. And over that time, having the chance to really learn about the complexities of that issue. So hearing from stakeholders, hearing from government, understanding budgetary constraints, legal constraints, hearing from different community groups that might be affected, and then doing that really hard work together to find common ground on a shared set of recommendations. And so these citizens' assemblies are quite different in nature, I think, from what I described to many participatory urbanism approaches that I think listeners might be more familiar with. So instead of kind of being open to anyone to participate, which in itself sounds like a nice principle, anyone who's ever been to one of these things knows that it tends to be the same kind of people, the same demographics, and usually people are coming out with their own self-interest, usually when they're against something. Whereas here, we're trying to get past just those really mobilized groups of people, bringing together a much more representative group of people across the community, and really creating the space and conditions to be with the complexity, the trade-offs of the issues involved, and also creating those relationships with the investors, developers, architects, urbanists, councillors, and people in the public administration that are all in some way involved in these decisions together, trying to transform that into a much more constructive relationship.
Now, of course, you spoke to hundreds of people. There are multiple conversations here. And I know that what I'm about to ask differs not only throughout the world, but also if you look at a national versus local level. But focusing on cities, following these conversations, what are your thoughts on the state of democracy in cities and at the local level after hearing from a multitude of voices?
Yeah, well, this was the interesting part of the work as well, because we convened an international task force that had 15 people from 15 different countries and those different kinds of profiles. So a mix of architects, investors, urbanists, public authorities, etc. But we also engaged with a group of over 100 stakeholders that were from about 40 different countries, also across those different kind of profiles that we convened in a series of meetings. They gave us feedback on these drafts. So it's been really interesting to see actually that cities across the world, even though, of course, there will be slightly different political, contextual things to keep in mind, a lot of them are really facing a lot of the same challenges. And we really heard over and over again that these democratic problems are often at the heart of why a lot of decisions are kind of getting blocked and there's no action being taken in the first place, or there's just a lot of tensions around these decisions needing to be taken. And in the sector, there's been different conversations about, well, how do we change maybe the policies, or how do we experiment with different kinds of engagement methods? And I think those things have been fine, but they clearly haven't been shifting things in a more systemic and structural way. So our thinking here was about how could we be really trying to do the hard work, which will take longer and more time and effort, but really work on starting to change how do these decisions always get taken, which might require changes to regulation or legislation to make that happen in an ongoing way. It might mean establishing permanent citizens' assemblies like we've seen in Paris and other cities in Europe as well, drawing inspiration from some of these changes that are already going in that direction, that are trying to shift in that more structural way the relationship between the different actors that are involved in these kind of decisions.
What are some of the ways then that we can make city planning more democratic? I know you've just mentioned a few of those examples, but you know, people listening to our conversation and reading the paper, if they want to adapt thinking about the future of the built environment and of our cities and want to have a more democratic approach to it, how can they do it?
Yeah, it's a good question. And in the paper, we outlined 6 different entry points, starting with different scenarios that a city might be in, knowing that if you were to try to do all of them at once, it would feel like an immense undertaking. But actually, if you did do all of them, it would be completely transformative to how city planning works today. So for example, one of them is around rethinking how engagement happens around big infrastructure projects, which are also usually really long-term affairs. So, you know, one of our task force members is from Copenhagen, where they're debating building a whole island off the coast of Copenhagen. It's a 100-year project. So how do you rethink the way that it's not just about engaging people once, one time at the very beginning of all of this, but in a more ongoing way at different decision-making points? Another set of proposals is for developers, actually, who often have legal requirements to do some form of engagement. So showing them that actually, instead of the sort of town hall meeting style things they're used to, they could be convening a citizens' assembly type model earlier on in some of their decision-making to de-risk their decisions by avoiding potential future protests that would slow down or stop projects entirely, by getting that more meaningful, constructive input from a wider diversity of people in that community in the first place. Some of the other proposals concern amendments to the legal rules and codes around zoning things, for instance. Another proposal relates to, you know, most cities have longer term, often 10-year, but, you know, sometimes a bit shorter or longer plans, rethinking how those plans get made, because then a lot of policies end up trickling down from from what gets set in that plan. The two other ones relate to, one is about neighbourhood councils or community boards. They go by different names, rethinking both how they work and their functions in connection to planning teams, to city councils. And then finally, the last and I would say most ambitious one is establishing a legal basis for an institutionalised, ongoing citizens' assembly that would be addressing different types of planning issues. And so we have different examples of this now in the world. So Bogota in Colombia has done this. One of our task force members was involved in setting that up. We also had Daniel Fusca from the City of Toronto, who was involved in the Toronto Planning Review Panel, which is a 2-year, longer-term panel that's established. I was also personally involved in designing the permanent citizens assembly in Paris, which is not specifically focused just on planning, but actually all the sorts of issues they've been addressing so far have been planning issues, because that's actually one of the main types of decision making and competencies and challenges that many cities are facing. So that's just sort of the overview of, you know, a city doesn't necessarily need to try to do all of these things at once, but no matter what its context, there's an entry point to get started on step by step making some really transformative change happen.
It was really interesting, the point you brought up about the follow through and the follow up as well when you're working on these long term projects. And I wonder if that is the key then to this question of democracy in cities and in planning, a question of checking in. Is that the best way to simplify things and to describe it?
I think that's definitely part of it. I think it kind of goes even beyond just checking in. I think when we're thinking about establishing these institutionalized citizens' assemblies, that means we're thinking holistically about the relationship, not just with the city council, with the executive, but also with the public administration. And so it's transforming what is the accountability that gets held between these different groups. For example, when we were working on the design of the permanent citizens' assembly on climate in the region of Brussels, we also thought about what is the feedback loop. So amongst the 50 citizens assembly members, there's a smaller group of 10 that gets randomly selected that after the assembly ends, they meet with the minister every 6 months for at least 18 months to get an update on where things are in terms of implementation, what is being implemented and how, if there's certain aspects of what they propose that couldn't be done, to also get that interaction. Because it's not necessarily that absolutely everything that the assembly proposes will necessarily happen, even though I personally think that we need to be moving in that direction of having these assemblies as decision-making authorities. At the moment, that's quite complex because often that comes up against constitutional issues of what's possible. So in these models where the assemblies are permanent, the ultimate authority still rests with elected officials. But it's about how do we transform that relationship and how do people who are the power holders, how do they feel also an accountability to citizens who spend many months going into the complexities of these issues to be really transforming the relationship, because you were asking about democracy earlier. And I think this is part of the heart of the problems we have in democracy today, that people feel a real lack of agency in shaping decisions affecting their lives. There's a lack of trust, not just amongst people in government, but amongst government in people and also people amongst each other. And these are hard problems to solve that don't have a magic solution to them. And so it's part of why I believe in the need for citizens' assemblies that create the spaces for diverse groups of people to spend lengthy periods of time doing hard work together. And there's no magic shortcut to kind of rebuilding that trust and giving people a real sense of agency.
Claudia Schwalis there in conversation with Carlotta Rebello. In June, voters in Serbia's capital, Belgrade, will be heading back to the polls for the second time in 6 months. A stake, not just the control of Belgrade municipality, but the future face of the city. Because the visions of the governing and opposition parties couldn't be much further apart on everything from heritage to transport. And there's one important group of people who feel their input is sorely needed. Architects and urbanists. Monocle's man in the Balkans, Guy Delaunay, can tell us more about the battle for Belgrade.
For 5 years, I called Belgrade home. As a native of Liverpool, I felt an instant affinity. Both cities were built for a greater purpose. My birthplace was the commercial and trading centre of an empire. My new base had been the capital of a federation uniting all the southern Slavs. The question is, what do you do when that greater purpose has gone away? Liverpool has been grappling with that question for the best part of a century and seems to have settled on embracing and repurposing its heritage. Belgrade, on the other hand, hasn't had nearly as much time to consider its direction following the demise of Yugoslavia. But in the past few years, it's been making up for lost time. A new central railway station is finally open, the long-awaited metro project has started, and many of the city's squares have been remodeled. Less positively, historic housing in central areas is being demolished at an alarming rate to be replaced by supposedly high-end apartments. Most prominent of all is the massive Belgrade waterfront project with its residential and retail towers. The projects have faced fierce opposition from locals who feel the remaking of the city is being decided from the top down. They believe political connections count for more than properly thought out urbanism, and the protest movement Nedavimo Beograd, Don't Let Belgrade Drown, has become a significant player in municipal politics. And it's not just lay people who are concerned about the direction the city is taking. Professionals also reckon there are serious problems with the way decisions are made and the consequences for the face of Belgrade.
The development of Belgrade is too intensive, outside the rules of urban plans and traditional habits in urban planning.
Jelena Ivanović-Vojvodić is from the Serbian Academy of Architects, and she's also one of the founders of Belgrade International Architecture Week. This year's theme is the protection of modern heritage in the city.
The development is really important, how it looks like from the riverside. And if you look the city from the riverside, you could see this huge development. It looks like it comes from the other planet. It's blocked the view to the old part of the city with no connection to the city heritage architecture and with no connection to the landscape and the river.
When we're talking about who controls the city, how are these decisions for these big changes made? Were the people who live in Belgrade, were the professionals like yourself, were you able to have any say in these changes before they happened?
All these agreements are taking in the fields between the political parties, between their connections to the investment directly and without public opinions. So we would like to be engaged, and we will give our voice, and we will try in the future to change something.
And we have elections coming up in June. The parties who are running in the elections have very different ideas about what the city should look like, what the city should be. What do you think the stakes are, the consequences could be of the elections in June?
We should do more regulations on these democratic issues. So we will be a part of the future of our city, because we do not want to see these enormous changes which are ruining our history. And without a history, we don't have a future.
And it's not just been the big projects, has it? Because every time I go back to Belgrade, I can go around some streets in some of the older districts like Dorćol or Vračar, and these old buildings, some of these old villas, which date back more than 100 years, are being knocked down and new developments being put in their place, which maybe are not the best suited to those locations.
True. I think this is the only way how Europe and also Belgrade and Serbia should be developed, by the reconstructions, not by these newly development which are not looking like our part.
In terms of the process for decisions being made, how could we improve on what's gone before?
It's really simple. Back to the you know, our rules. So our rules are, we don't have, you know, somebody like a magic person to solve all our projects, but we will go through these public competitions, which could be, you know, in different levels, asking everybody, what do you think about it? And the second level is some kind of professional level in which we could get some kind of ideas. Without domestic architects, without cooperation with the people here, I think we could not have something which will be our future.
The Nedavimo Beograd protesters have been warning that the soul of the city is at stake. In this June's elections, voters will have a chance to say how they want the future to look. A continuation of the current top-down policy with little in the way of consultation, or perhaps a more collaborative approach with citizens, architects and urbanists all having their input in how Belgrade develops. For Monocle, in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Finally today, with around half of the world population participating in elections this year, and the UK guaranteed a general election before the year is through too, it's more important than ever to know how we end up presented with the options that we get to choose from. UK in a Changing Europe, a think tank which provides research and analysis of some of the issues facing the UK, recently held a panel discussion unpacking how political parties choose their candidates. The event's chair and the organisation's director, Anand Menon, spoke with Carlotta Ribello, and Carlotta began by asking Anand what we know about the process of political parties choosing their prospective candidates for office.
Well, we know more because there are certain people, including a couple of people who were on our panel discussion the other day, have decided to look into it. I mean, we're learning more from people like Michael Crick, who are going around the country attending selection meetings. But it has been, to date, I think, an element of our politics that has been shrouded in, if not secrecy, then sort of confusion. And I think that's weird because obviously these people that get selected as candidates, some of them go on to become MPs and some of them go on to become ministers. So it's a part of our system we really ought to know more about than we do.
Now, that whole issue of transparency in politics comes up throughout all election cycle and throughout government. But as you say, this seems like to be an element of it that actually has some pretty big consequences for then how the country is run, that the vast majority of the public does not feel involved at all.
No, absolutely. And that's partly because of the way we've chosen to do this. You know, we toyed once under David Cameron, if I recall, with open primaries. But at the moment, what all the parties do is party members in the constituencies select candidates. And that's one of the reasons why it's quite hard to follow, because these processes of candidate selections tend to be dispersed around the country. They take place over a long period of time. They tend to be quite low key. They don't tend to be publicised outside of the membership of that constituency party itself. So there are good reasons why this is difficult to follow. I suppose one of the thrusts of the argument at our panel the other week was that we should probably be trying to put a bit more effort into figuring out what's going on than we do at the moment.
And what does that mean for voters then? Because often, as you were just describing, they only find out quite late in the process who is up for representing their patch in the country. What does that mean, for example, for those trying to run as independents? Or perhaps if I want to see change where I live, often when you figure out that the process has already happened. So I'm just curious to hear your perspective on the role of voters and of independent candidates in this scenario.
Well, I mean, there are several different things bundled up in that question. I mean, when it comes to independents and the difficulty that they face in getting elected, I think there the issue is an issue of our electoral system. I mean, our first-past-the-post system makes it very, very difficult for smaller parties to come into being and to attract voters, because we're pressured into voting with the first-past-the-post system for a party that we think has a chance of winning. But I think for people who are interested in politics, it is curious, I think, that it's not obvious how you go into it. So, you know, if you deal with a student, for instance, who says, I want to become a politician, there's no easy manual. What you need to do is join a local party and, in a sense, follow their own rules. And each local party does things slightly differently. And if and when a vacancy comes up, you can stand for it. One of the big issues that came up in the conversation the other day, actually, was the enormous emphasis now being placed on localism. That's to say, constituency parties increasingly plump for the candidate who has good, provable local links. So gone are the days when prospective parliamentarians could wander around the country standing as a candidate in all sorts of seats wherever they were, because it's far, far harder as an outsider now to be selected.
And in theory, that would be a good thing or a bad thing? Because when it comes to representation and this idea of who holds the power in our cities, for example, let's use cities as an example here, I wonder where that localism, what role that plays into that conversation.
Well, I'm going to give you a really sort of dull answer here. And it's probably neither a good thing nor a bad thing. On the one hand, it is obviously important that constituencies are represented by their MPs. And in the past, our politics has veered a long way from this, you know, with MPs sort of proudly saying, I very rarely go back to my constituency. I spend my time in Westminster and I might make a sort of royal visit once a year just to check in on the people. It is harder to do that now because constituents expect to be represented. And you can see that, for instance, in the amount of time MPs spend on their Instagram proving they're in their constituency. On the other hand, you need MPs to do a lot of other stuff in Westminster. We need MPs to be legislators. We need MPs to be there to scrutinise legislation. And for me, one of the most striking things of our panel the other day was how the panellists just very quickly agreed that actually, to all intents and purposes, the House of Commons has passed the role of scrutiny over to the House of Lords, which is where most of the legislative scrutiny we have goes on now. And I was amazed that that passed without comment, without demur, as if this was just a settled state of affairs. So it's a question of getting the balance right between having people who focus on their local areas and people who focus on national politics. And the way selection occurs, there's no way of ensuring that balance because it's a very fragmented and decentralized way of doing things.
And of course, you lead UK in a Changing Europe, the academic think tank. And I'm curious on how, you know, since the UK's departure from the EU, since we stopped having in this country elections for the European Parliament, for example, has that changed this process in terms of, was that a more open and more transparent process than what we've been talking so far? How has that impacted the way people feel represented?
Well, I don't think candidate selection for European Parliament elections was massively different from candidate selection for other elections, except for the fact that, of course, we had a different sort of electoral system for European elections, which meant that with a list system, in a sense, the party hierarchy had more control because the leadership of the party decided what order the names went on the party list. The one big difference, I mean, it's a really interesting difference, I think, that not being in the European Union makes in this sense is that European elections were a very good opportunity for smaller parties to do well. You know, one of the great paradoxes of Brexit is that the Reform Party, the heir of UKIP and the Brexit Party, finds it harder to operate now without the fillip of European elections, because European elections were a time when UKIP could expect to get a lot of coverage, could, in a couple of cases, in both 2015 and again 2019, won European elections. And of course, having members of the European Parliament was an excellent source of revenue for smaller parties. And of course, that is now gone.
And just one question then. We do not know the date for the general election, but we do know for the London mayoral election, which is coming up this May. The process there of knowing the candidates is a bit more open and people are a bit more involved. Do you feel like that has to do with the fact that we're dealing with a city and people perhaps pay more attention to issues that might affect them directly in their literal neighbourhood than perhaps the big scheme of national politics and the long deadlines of when things might get done? I'm just interested in the parallels here between the two types of elections that are looming in the UK.
I think, I mean, there are two elements there, time and space. Now, time's obviously an issue because quite often at national level, if you have a snap election, then candidate selection is very, very rushed, which we saw all too clearly in 2017. Parties were unable to do due diligence on the people who were standing for them. So there is that. You get a predictable amount of time with the mayoral election. I also think there are fewer mayoral elections. And for things like London, because the London mayoral contest is a far higher profile contest than any single constituency one, then people pay more attention. The selection process, as you say, is more open, with parties looking to choose a candidate. Central office is more directly involved in those choices. So it's a different sort of process, I think. And I'm not sure you could replicate that for constituency level, simply because we've got 650 constituencies and the workload would just be huge.
Anand Menon there, speaking with Carlo Tribello. And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. You can get new editions of the show every week. Just follow us through your favourite podcast provider. And you can also subscribe to Monocle magazine for regular reports on all things design, architecture and urbanism. Just visit monocle.com. The Urbanist is produced by Carlo Tribello and by David Stevens, who also edits this show. I'm Andrew Tuck. Goodbye. And thank you for listening, City Lovers.